I'm Chris Mandel, director of the Sedgwick Institute. Welcome to this installment of Sedgwick Institute Live, where I profile influential thought leaders who make a difference and whose interests lie in the risk and insurance world. Today, I'm talking to Becky Robinson, AVP or Assistant Vice President of Risk Management for Hobby Lobby. With over 25 years in the industry, Becky has a wealth of knowledge making Hobby Lobby one of the great companies in the United States. Welcome, Becky, to Sedgwick Institute Live.
Wow. Well, thank you for that introduction, Chris. I appreciate it. I don't know that I deserve that accolade, but thank you.
Oh, well, I always try to start with a high point. So good to have you on our podcast. Hope things are going well for you. Let's start with the personal, if you don't mind. Tell me a little bit about your family and what you do for fun.
Sure. So I have two daughters. My older one is in her second year up at Oklahoma State University. She is pursuing a pre-med. She wants to be a anesthesiologist. So she has a long path ahead of her, but doing quite well.
Wow.
Yeah. And then my younger one is currently busy mastering eighth grade.
Awesome. Well, you got somebody that will probably help you with your retirement if she's going to be an anesthesiologist. That's awesome.
That's my plan. That's my plan. And,
very good. Like, what do you do for fun besides hang with your girls?
Well, you know, over the last probably 3 or 4 years, I've been trying to focus the girls to go outside, unplug, and unwind. So some of the things we like to do is we'll take an annual vacation. We'll either go to the mountains, do some hiking, do some skiing, or, you know, just go to the beach. But just get outside and enjoy nature and just try to get away from the smartphones, get away from the iPads, get away from TV and all that social networking that they seem to be too plugged into these days.
Yeah,
and then, of course, in the fall, we're big OSU fans, so we like to tailgate and go to the season football games.
Awesome. You live in Oklahoma City?
Just outside Oklahoma City in a town called Edmond, yes.
Mm-hmm. Very good. All right, well, let's turn to your career in the risk world. And why don't you just give me a snapshot of what you have been doing, you know, since you got into it?
Well, I'm a bit of an anomaly, I would say, because I've been, as you said in the intro, I've been with Hobby Lobby for over 25 years. I joined the organization in 1992, and they had about 45 store locations. We were in 7 states. They brought me on to focus on the rising work comp costs. They were in several assigned risk pools back in those days, no understanding or management of claim costs. And today, we have over 850 store locations. We're in 48 states. And our risk management department is really quite sophisticated. So starting from where I started back in 92, we now have 30 employees. We have in-house adjusters. We manage our liability in-house. We manage some occupational injury in-house. We are also responsible for the safety at the stores. And we have an on-site staff attorney.
Hmm. Wow. Pretty impressive. You don't have any stores outside the U.S. yet, or is that not part of the long-term plan?
We don't currently. There's been, you know, some discussion. I think it's really just that at this stage. But we do have an overseas office that we work with closely in Hong Kong and Shenzhen, China. But other than that, we're pretty much a domestic company.
Mm-hmm. And are you privately owned? Is that a correct understanding?
Right. Yes, we are.
Yeah. Family owned, as I understand it, right?
That's correct, right.
Very good. Well, so how did you get into Hobby Lobby? What was the lead into that and then into risk management?
Well, it was really by chance. I was working for an accounting firm, Grant Thornton, and I was going to school part-time to finish up my degree. Hobby Lobby used Grant to perform their annual audit and some tax work. And I became pretty familiar with the folks here at Hobby, and they offered me an opportunity to come and oversee their workers' comp piece, which, of course, has changed dramatically over the years. I had no knowledge of risk management nor the work comp claim process at all, and really had no interest in it, you know, at that time. But, you know, having the exposure here and being able to grow into the position and grow into a lot of different responsibilities and different tasks, it's really been a great final resting place for me. Fits well with my strengths. And it's been fun to kind of just see what Hobby Lobby does. You know, we are primarily retail, but we've made movies. We've insured some unique coverages. And, of course, we had some dabbling with the Bible Museum up in Washington, D.C. So it's been kind of a fun, exciting experience. As soon as I learn one type of risk, something else is introduced. So it's been interesting.
Were you an auditor with Grant Thornton?
I was actually not. No, I was just a secretary working there part-time while I was going to school. So it's kind of interesting how I fell into this. You know, I hadn't finished my degree. I finished it once I came to Hobby. And, yeah, just like I said, it was really by chance. I was in the right place at the right time.
Now, I had no idea that Hobby Lobby was involved with movie making. What was that about?
So yeah, that it was actually really fun. I've got a notation in the movie script, so that's kind of exciting. But they made a movie, and I actually got to insure. We flew out to Hollywood, met with some folks, and learned a lot about the industry. And actually got to insure monkeys and tigers. We actually had a business interruption claim, which was really interesting. It was a film about some missionaries that went overseas. And our lead actor actually had some chafing going on and couldn't perform, so we had a BI claim. So it was really interesting to see the different components and, you know, how those coverages are considered versus what we typically see in retail production.
Yeah, quite different.
And, yeah, quite different.
What was the name of the movie?
Walk His Trail, and we've also done quite a few documentaries. Into Despair, Walk His Trail was the documentary. And I was thinking
it might have been End of the Spear.
It is End of the Spear.
Oh, it is? You did End of the Spear. Oh, that's an awesome movie.
Yeah.
I love it.
I'm in the credits.
Two of my three kids are missionaries, so I have a personal interest in that subject. So, cool. So what's been the best and biggest accomplishment in your career so far, or maybe more broadly, your life?
I've been really fortunate to be part of the organization that supports me. They've really encouraged our ideas and all the efforts that we attempt to make some modifications to mitigate the risk. We've developed a lot of creative solutions, but I would really say that my most significant accomplishment, or really the best opportunity I had to be involved in, was the work comp reform in the state of Oklahoma. In 2013, we were part of a coalition that started up between Hobby Lobby and another company in the state, Unit Corporation. And these two entities came together. We formed a coalition and began to pursue businesses and make folks aware of the challenges that the state of Oklahoma was facing in workers' comp. NCCI had us ranked as the fifth highest claim cost out of 47 states. And the Oregon study I think it's released every 2 years, had us ranked as the fourth most expensive premium in the country. So we were tasked with communicating with the Oklahoma legislators and explaining our story, the Hobby Lobby story, and what we experience on a national level. I was able to share results with these legislators and get them to understand why this is important for the state of Oklahoma and how businesses are leaving, the economy was being affected by it, and more importantly, our employee base was being affected by it because we were seeing employees that were injured, not coming back to work. They would have multiple surgeries, and it was just a real challenge you know, to take care of the employees, but also try to save the organization money from the claim costs. So the idea was to switch the system from a court-based system to an administrative system, which was one of the last states, I think, to move to an administrative system. And we were very successful. In 2013, Senate Bill 1062 passed. In 2014, we moved from the court-based system, which there is still a court of existing claims that handles the runoff, the new claims are under the administrative system. And it's saved the Oklahoma businesses a significant amount of premium and claim cost. NCCI has also recognized the improvements. They've issued loss cost filing reductions almost every year in the last 5 years, which accumulate to about 60% savings, so or 60% filing costs. So I think the results are still yet to be determined, but we're on a really good track. And it was a interesting time in my life to be part of something so visceral from the plaintiff bar, and you know, there you learn who the stakeholders are, and they're not who you think they are. But but it was also, you know, really, really rewarding, and we have developed, you know, some good relationships with some of those plaintiff attorneys. So I think that's
so
probably my
how far did you bend the loss curve for Hobby Lobby? What kind of reductions and rates have you been able to achieve?
So we have a high deductible program in Oklahoma, and our average claim costs in Oklahoma, depending on the body part, would range from $4,000 to up to $15,000 for a strain. And we just weren't seeing some great management because the plaintiff bar would be so involved. I think we had about 10% of our claims were going into litigation. And that's also because we're a high-profile employer in the state of Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our numbers have trended down so greatly, and part of that is because the AMA guides has changed from the 5th edition, which was recognized under old law, to the 6th edition. And so we're not seeing those PPD awards that we used to see under the old system. So our average claim cost is now $1,500 to roughly, I would say, about $7,000-$8,000 on the strains. And that's even trending a little bit high as well. We still see some litigation, but it slowed down significantly. There were several parts of the act that were challenged. So that a lot of the claims were in limbo for quite some time because of the AMA decision. But that's been decided, and AMA 6th edition is now sticking, which is fantastic news for the state of Oklahoma employers.
So you labeled that work comp reform, but wasn't that the same bill that option legislation was introduced into Oklahoma by?
Yes, that's correct, yeah. The option was one of the components of Senate Bill 1062, and mm-hmm. that was found unconstitutional. But the rest of the administrative system stayed intact.
So I know you didn't necessarily trigger the option for your company. I remember you and I talking about you taking a more of a wait-and-see approach at that time. This would probably have been in 15 when we were talking about it. But what's your view of it in the aftermath of the Supreme Court decision?
You know, I think that it can work in many different jurisdictions. We didn't feel confident that it would be successful in the state of Oklahoma because of there was no groundwork such as like Texas has it in their constitution. They have a lot of case law. There wasn't that here in Oklahoma. And so that's why the option was tied to exclusive remedy, so you didn't have that exposure to be sued. Under those circumstances, I think it would have been really successful in Oklahoma. But removing the exclusive remedy, it just opened up or would open up the employers to a significant amount of risk. And so that's why we were more in a wait-and-see mode to see how, mm-hmm. number one, the Supreme Court was going to rule on that. But also I just wasn't sure if the exclusive remedy would stick, if the option did stick, but it all, was disbanded.
Do you think, as some do, that it'll be resurrected at some future date?
You know, it could be. And I know that there are several efforts underway to see this movement nationally in other states that might be more receptive to it. And I think that there could be a lot of lessons learned from what we saw here in Oklahoma. The plaintiff bar is really strong here. Mm-hmm. If it does become resurrected, certainly it won't have the exclusive remedy tied to it. I think there needs to be, you know, some fail-safe for employers if they do, you know, pursue something similar to that.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, you know, Hobby Lobby's been involved in a number of challenges to the way they do business by the government. I call it kind of governmental overreach. What are your thoughts about your culture and the fight that you guys have led vis-a-vis your owners and leadership in terms of doing things that you think are right? What are your? I'd love to hear your thoughts about all that.
Yeah, so that was an interesting time for all of us that, you know, worked here at Hobby Lobby and, you know, saw what the leaders were involved in. And I do appreciate you asking this question. There was a lot of misinformation in the public regarding our company and their pursuit of, you know, defending their beliefs against the Affordable Care Act. Some, I think, even portrayed our leadership as being really cold and lacking understanding for families. Mm-hmm. But what didn't come out, and I don't know that many of your listeners know, is how well the organization takes care of the employees. They started raising the national full-time minimum wage for every employee at Hobby Lobby starting in 2010, and we have consecutively raised that minimum wage every year, where it's currently at $15.70. So regardless of where you work, whatever state that you're in, if you are a full-time employee, you will be hired at a rate of $15.70.
Wow, that's impressive.
It is impressive, and that information has never really been shared in the public. But it's, you know, I think what people don't understand about our leaders is how much they do care about the employees, and they do put them first. You know, that mm-hmm. certainly they are principled leaders, and I do respect that 100%. We also have an on-site health clinic at the corporate campus that provides full medical care without a copay, without a deductible, even has an MRI facility. So if you need an MRI, you don't even have to pay for an MRI.
Wow.
So they do quite a bit for the employees. And, mm-hmm. and you know, during that time when all the negative publicity was out there, it was unfortunate that some of these other great things that they do really didn't make it to the air.
Mm-hmm. So I assume it hasn't changed the way the owners and leaders in your company feel about the issues and would just as soon take up the same fight again if it came back?
You know, they would. One thing that I wasn't sure about, we've never been in the public eye prior to that. We've mm-hmm. always been in the background. You know, we've never really put the name Hobby Lobby out there. And to see them take such a strong position on this national level, on this national stage, it's really quite remarkable, and I know that they would do that 10 times over if presented with the same circumstances. And it's, again, working for principled leaders, you know what you're getting. They are who they say they are behind closed doors and certainly on the national stage.
Yeah. No, that's a great attribute, principled leadership. It's not easy to find sometimes. Well, let's turn to the risk management world more specifically. Where do you see it going in the next 10 years? Anywhere different than it is?
You know, I think it's always going to be different. It's always going to be changing. I think certainly we've been in a position being privately held to kind of do some things out of the box. and really position the organization from a risk perspective a little differently than some of my peers who maybe, you know, have a different leadership or maybe not at the privately held level like us. But it's given us a lot of opportunities kind of dabble in different areas. And I think, you know, while we see a lot of changes in technology and data developing trends and, you know, establishing where your risk retention level should be, I mean, that's always going to be there. But I think we can use that data a little bit more creatively to really do more cost-benefit analysis and really spend some time on some unique opportunities. But we just need to be a little bit more creative, and we need to understand the exposure and really understand the industry, and certainly the jurisdiction will always play a part into that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be key, is the jurisdiction. But I think where we, you know, like to talk about AI and like to talk about all this technology and all these data elements, what will never go away, in my view, is the relationship. I think risk management is full of relationships. You can have all the data in the world. You can, you know, develop spreadsheets and cost-benefit analysis, but if you can't share your story, it's meaningless. And so I think that the relationship will always be key, regardless of where the industry goes and how risk develops and ERM and all of those faculties associated with that. You know, we're never going to get away from the relationship, and I would hate to see that go away.
Who or what position do you report to in your organization?
I report to the CFO. I've actually moved around in different areas. I've reported to legal. My favorite has been reporting to the CFO because we are on the same page. Financial impact, I can relate to those, and I can pick up data elements and associated with the financial exposure. When I reported to legal, it wasn't the best marriage for risk, in my view, because they were always looking at it from a lawsuit perspective. And I think some of those decisions have to be economically based. So we work well with legal, but I like the role of risk management reporting directly to the CFO.
Do you feel like, you know, your C-suite, CEO, and board understand and get the risk management strategy you've employed?
I would say for the most part they do. It's interesting because, you know, from time to time we'll get an initiative to say, well, we're considering just self-insuring all of our stores. And I have to kind of go back and say, well, you know, our lease obligations are XYZ. We have to do, you know, make sure that we have a minimum of this. And then I also share the losses with them and where the thresholds were and, you know, what insurance premium we paid versus what the actual losses were. So we do spend a lot of time communicating the benefit of risk management rather than just, you know, the cost on a on the accounting ledger. So I think for the most part they do understand, but we do, you know, still have those conversations. And, you know, if we want to change the retention levels, you know, we're going to go through those cycles as well.
All right. That's good. So what do you think is the secret to a successful life in business?
You have to love your job. I really think you have to love your job or love what you're doing. You know, we go through ebbs and flows. You know, there are times where you're really frustrated, but at the end of the day, you have to love what you do. And you have to feel good about the work that you do. I always say that that's sleep insurance. If you can sleep based on the decision that you made for the company that day or for, you know, your team or the organization's outlook, if you can go to bed and feel good about those decisions, even when they don't always go the way that you intended, I think that, you know, if you've got that sleep insurance, then you'll be happy in life and business. But, yeah, you have to love your job and feel good about the work that you do.
Well, it doesn't hurt when you're in an employee-friendly culture as well, right?
Right.
What advice would you give university students who are thinking about going into this business, this risk management business?
So we work with a couple of different universities here in Oklahoma, primarily the University of Central Oklahoma. They have a finance and risk management program. And when I talk to them, I always tell them to look at all the options. The field is really, really broad. You know, Oklahoma is limited on the companies that have a risk management department, but there are a lot of carriers. There's a lot of opportunities to go into underwriting, go into claims. And then there's also certain disciplines associated with that, the vendors that support these organizations. And so I just tell them, be open. And, you know, if you're going to pursue an interest in one of those areas, keep your integrity. I tell them to be honest in the work that you perform and never burn a bridge, because I've seen so many people move from one side to the other side. And you've got to develop yourself as a knowledge resource, number one, but also develop that integrity that follows you, so that when you do transition maybe from a broker to an employer or from an underwriter to a claims person, that respect and integrity follows you as well. So I just always tell them, you know, stay focused, look at options, and don't burn bridges.
What about specific skills? I mean, what do you think the few skills are that are really critical to succeeding in risk management?
Well, I do think a background in finance is really important. I mean, we can't get away from the data. It's always going to come down to the data. You can tell your story, but you have to know what the numbers mean. And if you don't have some type of financial background or accounting background or some way to interpret that information, I think you're going to struggle in your future. I also think that you have to understand what the tolerance level is of the organization that you're working for. So it's really specific skill sets, you know, understanding the financial piece, but also understanding the people piece, knowing what your audience will understand and how to present to your audience. It's really a skill set that you have to develop over time. You know, some leaders, they like to see the numbers in spreadsheets and PowerPoints, and others, they want a one-pager. So it's a discipline, really, that will be developed, but the primary skill, I would say, really is the financial piece.
Mm-hmm. Well, being owned by a TPA, I always like to ask what, you know, risk managers really think about how valuable or not TPAs are to the success of their strategies. What are your thoughts about TPAs and the claim management profession as it relates to the broader risk management world that you live in?
Well, I certainly think that the TPA is an extension of your organization, and you need to consider them as your risk partner. And similarly, they need to consider your role as well when you're developing your claims program. We particularly have a certain set of guidelines internally for our team. And without sharing that information with our TPA, they can't be our partners. So they need to understand what our expectations are, you know, we'll be successful if we work together. I think you should regularly review the claims handling instructions. They're going to change over time. They always do. You know, as litigation becomes more prevalent, as things, change in the regulations in different jurisdictions, you need to be able to change as well. And I think having a partner that keeps you apprised of what's going on in those different jurisdictions, because you can't be everywhere, you have to rely on those relationships and the knowledge base of your TPA.
Well, how important is that advisory role from the claim provider versus what you might get from a broker or some other consultant source? Is it any more or less important from your point of view?
Well, I think I rely on the information from my TPA over my broker from a claims perspective, because they're dealing with the claims day in and day out. They're generally seeing the legislation in the different jurisdictions, so they can keep you apprised on what may be coming down. It's interesting because sometimes we'll hear about things from our attorneys and we'll pass it on to our TPA. And our TPA was like, oh, yeah, we put a white paper out on that. Here's that. Mm-hmm. So they're generally ahead of the curve on most of this when it comes to legislation.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say you may have already said it, but if there were one thing that you think TPAs ought to really do more of or better than they do today, what would it be?
I think really the communication on what's happening in those specific jurisdictions is really key. We do currently receive a lot of valuable information from a lot of our attorneys, but I think the fact that, you know, our adjusters are on site, will be interpreting any legislative change, they're going to be the knowledge resource that we rely on. So I think getting that information directly from the TPAs is really key. It's nice to get it from the attorneys, but in practicality, it's the adjusters that are going to be interpreting that.
Yeah. Well, good. That's helpful. So what are the plans for the balance of your career in risk management? Or are you going to maybe become a lawyer now?
Yeah, some people do say I like to argue. you know, we like to take initiatives every year. So, and I do like to think outside the box. I like to be creative. We're actually in the process of building out an occupational injury clinic for our campus, which will be the first spot for our injured employees. We have about 1,000 injuries, or incidents, I should say, a year at the campus, which is about almost 7,000 employees here in the state of Oklahoma at this 2-mile square area.
Hmm.
So by building out this occupational injury clinic, we'll remove some opportunities that we feel like can be abused in the workers' comp system. So the occupational injury clinic is a huge initiative for us. We're also going to put a physical therapy facility right behind it that will be shared by our occupational folks and our health clinic. So we'll be able to really get the care and treatment for our employees rather than, you know, following the, I hate to say this, but following ODG. You know, if they need a couple more visits, give them a couple more visits. But it gives us a creative opportunity because we're going to be paying the facility, the salaries with our contracted partner rather than actually having costs associated with it. So we're really excited about that. Not only will we see, you know, a reduction in claim costs, but I think it's going to improve the morale of the employees significantly and also the performance level. Time off from work should be narrowed as well. So that's a big initiative for us. I think, you know, in a couple of years we'll see the fruition of all of that. It's supposed to open, I think, in December. So it'll take a little while for us to really see the impact of it across many levels. And then really my real, I would say, primary focus is really on mentoring. We're seeing an aging workforce, as I know you've talked about historically and most recently as well. And we've changed our model to really grab those kids that graduate college with a risk or business pursuit and train them up and share with them, you know, what's happening in the risk industry. So we're doing a lot of mentoring and preparing and grooming some of those folks and really seeing how they develop. It's interesting because I actually have a meteorologist. You know, Oklahoma's got all kinds of weather issues, and so there's a big program at OU for meteorology. And I actually have a meteorologist that he couldn't find anything in that industry, and so we hired him up. And he's probably one of my best performers here. So it's interesting how you fall into risk. but really just seeing how they develop when you spend time with them and groom them and give them opportunities to develop.
So I take it he's not forecasting weather for you.
No, but he does do storm chasing. So, you know, we have to watch the weather, and he's out of here doing a storm chase. So.
That's funny.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it sounds like you're going to ride that Hobby Lobby horse to the end there. Good for you.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you.
Well, that's all I had to cover. Is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners before we close this up?
You know, I would just tell your listeners that those that are pursuing risk, I mean, you can see how I got into it. I had no intention. I just was at the right place at the right time and have had an incredible opportunity with a great organization. And I just hope your listeners know that there's not just one single path, that there are opportunities everywhere. And, you know, they need to stay the course, but maybe try different disciplines to find where their skill set really performs well. And that's really just what I would encourage them to think about.
Very good. It's funny you use that term. I just did a presentation in Australia and New Zealand entitled The Risk Management Journey, No One Right Way. And mm-hmm. I really believe that's true. You know, we all really need to do what our companies need done, not necessarily what some consultant says they should do, or what comes out of a box off the shelf. But hopefully people understand that. Well, thanks, Becky, for your time and your insights. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
To my listeners, you can find Dr. Victor's and my speaking and writing schedules, as well as other resources, at www.cedricinstitute.com. Please consider joining the Institute's LinkedIn group titled Cedric Institute, where we dialogue daily on issues of importance to stakeholders in the risk insurance world. Till next month, when we'll have our next installment of SI Live, where I'll interview another key leader in the risk business. In the meantime, I urge you to use your expertise and influence to make a difference whenever and wherever you can to make the industry better.